Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is The Guardian.
43% is going to take huge changes in our economy. It's going to be a huge fight to work out how to get that safeguard mechanism in place. There's going to be huge amounts of investment and pain and, you know, transmission lines through people's backyards and all sorts of stuff to deliver that 43%. And to belittle that around a sort of a kind of symbolic argument about a higher target is crazy.
Hello, lovely pod people. You're on Australian Politics and I'm Catherine Murphy. My guest this week is Felicity Wade. Felicity is the co-convener of the Labor Environment Action Network. Now, we'll get into what that is in this conversation. I just want to make clear, though, before we dive in for listeners, that this conversation was recorded earlier this week, Tuesday, shortly after the new Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, delivered a major statement on, the health of the Australian environment. And she set some signposts for the new government's thinking about how environmental regulation needs to be overhauled to make sure that we don't fry the planet, basically. Anyway, Felicity and I will get into all of those issues and many more. Listen up. Felicity, why don't we explain to people what is LEAN? What is the Labor Environment Action Network? What is this?
LEAN has been around actually in some form since about 2004, and it is the internal lobby group within the Labor Party on environment and climate. It was set up by two young Labor aspirants, Jenny McAllister and Christina Keneally, and did some good work in New South Wales right back then in the mid-2000s. It then had a couple of more iterations, but in about 2013, as Labor was facing a devastating loss where the coalition had really weaponized climate change so effectively, various people came to me and said, how about you rebuild LEAN? Because we're going to have a voice to hold the backlash. So LEAN is very much and proudly a grassroots organization. It's about giving Labor membership a voice on these issues. And I guess what is so overwhelming about what LEAN has done is that the Labor membership is passionate about climate and environment. And when asked, they have come out in droves to support our calls for stronger environment and climate change action.
And the point of it, too, is that it's, you know, it's a grassroots organisation within Labor, as you say, but it's also that story you tell about its origins, right, or the reboot. It's relevant in the to the extent that, you know, this organisation holds Labor's feet to the fire about climate action, as well as obviously making the case more broadly in the community, right? Like, as veteran of several Labor conferences watching Felicity organise to get motions onto the floor, which she inevitably has the numbers for, you know, I'm just explaining that it's a ginger group to keep Labor open and active about the imperative of action, as well as making that case to sort of hold back the general tide of, well, I don't know, what would you call it? Horrors.
Yeah, watching the planet die.
Yeah, watching the planet die.
No, yeah, and I guess the big two campaigns, you know, in the lead up to 2015, when Labor had this devastating loss, LEAN organised around what we call the 50-50 campaign, which was calling for 50% renewables and a 50% emission reduction target by 2030. 370 local branches. We had volunteers go out and just talk to people, go and, you know, get, you know, and we have quite a democratic process still in the Labor Party, often subverted, often, hard to see. Sure. But, you know, we decided to use that democratic process and got 370 local branches to endorse that position. We then went to the National Conference, which is the key policymaking forum of the party, and challenged the party to ignore the membership so clearly united. We did it again on the need to have new environment laws and an EPA when 500 Labor branches, yes. You know, there still are 600 or 700 Labor branches around the country of people who turn up once a month getting nothing from it but trying to make Australia a better place.
Yeah.
And we really decided that needed a voice, and that voice could be used to keep the pressure on the party.
And now we've explained that, your position in the firmament, people listening and who follow politics closely will know exactly why you're here, because we're in a very big week this week for the environment and for climate, because the 47th Parliament is about to open. And we'll get to the specifics of Chris Bowen and the climate bill. But this week, if you've been watching politics closely, you will know that the new Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, released the State of the Environment report, which is, well, just a disaster, basically.
Yes.
And set down some initial thoughts at the National Press Club, which we're going to work over in this conversation. So that's happening, and we've also got this run-up to whether or not Labor's first run of climate bills are actually going to pass this new parliament. So busy, busy, busy. So, you know, it seems ridiculous to ask, but I will ask, you know, are the climate wars over, Felicity?
If only they were. If only. I think what we have is a climate truce. You know, there was a very emphatic majority, I think you'd say, between Labor, Greens and the Teals at this election who said, that's enough, we need climate action. But it's only a few short years back to 2019 when communities who were going to be impacted by these changes also said, that's enough, we're not going to let you rip from underneath us our security and our job futures without taking due consideration. And then you mix into all of that, that's actually the real politic of real what electors think, and you mix into that the political aims and interests of both the left and the right of Australian politics, and we're sitting on a very precarious ledge trying to find a way forward.
Yeah, okay, we're on our ledge looking, surveying the scene. Everybody's retreated to their various corners, hydrating and sharpening their spears. Let's start with environment. On Tuesday, Tanya Plibersek released the State of the Environment report. She also gave a speech to the National Press Club, which in my line of work we would call a scene setter for where things are going to go over the next several years. You know, we can sort of imagine, I think, you and I, Susan Lee, standing up and fronting that report. I think we would have heard a different speech. There were sort of broad brushstrokes, but there's a lot of fine print in this area that really matters, and we're not really sure yet how much the new government is sort of going to, I guess, really reform the sort of critical areas of environmental regulation. So what did you make of the speech, just as a general bit of signalling? And then why don't we work through what needs to happen?
Sure. As Tanya explained very clearly in her speech, it's a very, very grim report. You know, we're extincting animals faster than anywhere else in the world. The greater glider and the koala being these kind of iconic, once common species are going through the floor. We've got a problem. We've cleared 7.7 million hectares of mm-hmm. threatened species habitat since 2000. And that's, you know, that's the size of Tasmania. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we are in a big mess. And I guess what was also really interesting in this report was for the first time, even though the report told the story, the same story as last time the report was written 5 years ago, instead of climate threats being a future thing, it really dealt with the fact that they're hitting us now.
Yeah.
The fires, the droughts, the floods are having devastating impact on the ability for the environment to function. So while I think a lot of us don't see it day to day, I think it's really important this report was there to say it's a real problem, you know. And I guess what one of the ways we're sort of as urban dwellers, sort of as Australians, sometimes starting to notice it is the bush is getting silenter.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to end up with a silent, animal-less bush.
Mm.
And that's just quite anathema, I think.
Yeah.
So, Tanya responded to that today. I mean, I think she pointed out that really importantly that there's all of the icons and it's really important we keep doing those, we keep protecting the places people love and so on and so forth, but systemic change has to happen.
Mm. So if you don't follow this area closely, What systemic change has to happen?
Look, Lane had worked very, very hard in opposition to really try and build a building, the sort of building blocks for what needs to happen. And I think one of the things we often refer back to, and I don't think it's unfair to say, the Hawke government was probably the last time we had an Australian government who was really trying to do this level of engagement of actually protecting the environment. Bob Hawke, of course, famously protected the Franklin. And for me, I was in early high school and that was my political awakening. It was, you know, a deep sense of nationalism about, you know, how beautiful Australia is. And it was a sense governments did important things. And that really, you know, was important for me. But he protected Kakadu. He did the international mining ban in Antarctica and so on and so forth. But probably even more importantly than that, he tried to think about the environment as part of the system of the economy and of the society.
Yep.
So in 1992, he launched the National Policy on Ecologically Sustainable Development, and there was a real attempt to start trying to work out what that meant across all the pieces of life in a society and in a government. The other really one I love is when he set up the Productivity Commission, which was called the Industry Commission at the time, he also set up Resource Assessment Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was setting up these key institutions to address the economic challenges, he sat beside it, an institution with exactly the same model of inquiry and investigation to think about how we deal with our natural world.
Yeah.
Paul Keating did basically dismantle both of those key initiatives. But leaving that aside, I think
it was good until it wasn't.
Yeah, it was good until it wasn't. Yeah. And, you know, and I guess with the dire news now, with business having shifted its position, the Albanese government has to match the Hawke government on that big picture thinking.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think? Obviously, you know, as they say in the classics, only time will tell. I'm racing you a bit because you need to work through the architecture first before we reach the point about whether or not any of this can or will happen. So keep going through the architecture.
Yeah, okay. So I think that the key pieces of architecture that I think are really, you know, there's 1,000 bits of rats and mice in environment and it's complicated. You know, that's one of the reasons it's hard to do and why governments have retreated. But the three pieces of architecture we've been thinking about is, first of all, the commitment to new environment laws and an EPA.
Yep.
Under the coalition, Graham Samuel did a review in the last couple of years, well-respected conservative figure who basically said it's a real mess.
Yeah.
They're rubbish laws. They're too complicated. There's no outcomes. All the things Labor said in 1999 when John Howard put them in place. For business, they also have problems with them. Apparently there's 31 different pathways to approvals. There's duplication. It's just a mess. So what Samuel talked about was, though, actually getting, rather than a process-driven set of laws, which is what we've got, we actually have laws which have outcomes in them that actually obligate the government to deliver things that actually protect the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And also to take the focus off development approvals, because that's what people have very much focused on, to actually also the proactive work of what do we have to do to keep the environment healthy. So we're really keen on seeing, Labor has already committed to this. Tanya talked about it today. We want Samuel's review delivered plus.
Yeah.
You know, Samuel's report is very good, but it was written in the political context in which he wrote it.
Yeah.
We need to think about climate change. Climate change isn't in the current laws. It needs to be. We need to think about what does it mean. The argument for not having them in last time around was that we had a carbon price, which was meant to be a sort of a driver of the whole business. We don't have that anymore.
No.
We have to put climate into both how we do approvals and how we also look after the place.
But Samuel, just because the climate trigger is really important, but it's not the only trigger I'm sure we'll talk about, Samuel wasn't into it though. Why?
I think Samuel did suggest that in big projects which had a big carbon impact that should be noted, that should be properly explained.
And we probably just actually need to break this down a fraction for people who aren't as enmeshed in.
Yes, this is the problem. You become a nerd really quickly in this space.
Well, first of all, let's explain what is a climate trigger. What is that? What is it in the context of what we're talking about?
Well, what is interesting is the interesting thing is that the term trigger has actually got quite obsolete from Samuel's proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how the old laws were set up was there was a set of triggers, as they were called, and these were called the matters of national environmental significance. These were the things that were identified as a Commonwealth responsibility coming out of treaties primarily, but a few extra things like threatened species and the loss of species. What Samuels is really talking about is rather than when you have to trigger an intervention from the government because there's a problem, is actually going back to standards. So you actually have an overarching kind of approach to things you're actually trying to deliver, and then things sit underneath that, if that makes a sense.
Yeah, it does.
And with climate change, I think it's really obvious there's a bunch of ways we have to consider it. We have to consider it in that very fundamental way of the climate impacts of new developments that has to be addressed. We have to think about it in terms of how it's affecting the environment and our ability to deliver healthy environments. And then we also just have to think about it in terms of how the environment is part of mitigating and managing and adapting to that problem.
Yes, yes.
So I think Samuel avoided that except for this quite particular proposal, but that is, I don't think that's an intellectually defensible position.
Yeah, right. And so is there, because I think Tanya Plibersek on Tuesday when she was at the club, she certainly didn't rule out a climate trigger. She certainly didn't rule it out, but she sort of proactively, even before she was asked a question about it, in that first question, she said, I'm not ruling anything out, but people who are looking for guidance or looking for signals from the podium need to think more about Graham Samuel than about the climate trigger. So I'll just ask it directly. If this circle can't be squared, and look, maybe it's not a precise climate trigger, maybe it's another sort of a mechanism that neither you nor I have thought about, but if the climate is not a part of environmental regulation, big problem, right? So Labor has to address that point in this term.
That's right.
Felicity is nodding.
I'm nodding, just helpfully on radio. Yes, that is correct, that climate has to be, I don't think it's avoidable. I think there'll be a big debate about how pointy that climate consideration is, of course.
Yeah, sure.
But we have to, that has to be,
has to be done.
That has to be done.
Anyway.
And I think I think there's a bunch of, we really need to review what else sits in the environmental legislation federally. Because I think, there's a long history legislatively. Of course, environment isn't mentioned in the Constitution. Yeah. So it's, always been a bit unclear. Yeah. But there's a long legislative or a long judicial history of the Commonwealth's ability, right to intervene on environment being quite strong. And I guess fundamental to this is, it's time for the feds to take over leadership again. I think that's the core message. And so plastics, I think, is one we need to think about. Mm-hmm. Land clearing isn't that one we need to think about.
Yep.
This is in the context of in 2018 and 19, that's only a few short years ago, 680,000 hectares was cleared in Queensland alone. Mm. 70,000 hectares of forests were logged. We are a global clearer in the top 10. We're the only developed country that is in that illustrious group, and we have to address that. So standards need to be strong. Those standards I talked about, rather than triggers, we're talking standards that need to be strong. We need to remove exemptions, and Samuel talked about this. One of the big ridiculous things in the EPBC Act is that the RFAs, which are the agreements that define how logging happens between states and federal governments, were exempted.
Yeah.
And yet the forests of Australia are where most of our species live. So an act that is set up to stop species going out backwards that exempts the very place where it all happens is a ludicrous suggestion.
Yeah.
And I guess the other thing is we believe, contrary to Graham Samuel, is that the federal government should maintain its decision-making powers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, backed up behind all that, Labor has already committed to an EPA, which Lean really worked its guts out to deliver. And we also believe we need an Environment Commission, reflecting so many other important areas of public policy where, independent advice for policy innovation that doesn't just come out of the NGOs or the governments or the universities or whatever, that you actually are empowering that kind of capacity for new ideas and for doing what needs to be done.
And, if you sort of take the Climate Change Authority as a model, and Chris Bowen in the legislation that we'll talk about in a few minutes, is setting up a regular reporting mechanism to Parliament, a sort of an independent assessment of progress under the targets and, other things as deemed necessary, right? There's a model for that in climate change, but yet there's been resistance to applying that model in environment. Why?
I don't know. Look, I think, you know, and I think climate change is the best analogy, the closest analogy, but, you know, we have independent, I mean, I know the RBA is probably a bit on the nose right now, but we have independent advice in Infrastructure Australia, a whole bunch of big important areas we do this, and yet there's been huge resistance. And the department does a lot of great things, but it does not innovate and it does not drive new ideas. And it does not hold, you know, it does not tell the truth to the public. You know, the State of the Environment report today is a once in a 5-year opportunity to do that, but we should entrench that capacity into building a better environmental kind of approach. So I think, you know, we'll be pushing hard on the analogy of the climate change architecture.
I know you'll be tapping on that door, but yes. So in terms of, you know, what will be serious in terms of, you know, you mean it. It's not just nice words that you say at the podium at the press club. These are structures that deliver the change that you are, you know, purporting to see.
Yeah, I think we cannot do, unless we do a serious reform, and it's not just, it's root and branch.
Yeah.
We will continue to lose, you know, the environment laws are totally and utterly inadequate to the task. Yeah. So that's number one. I'll quickly go through number two and number three. Yeah. So that's pillar one.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Tanya was quite clear on all that today, but, you know, the devil will be in the detail and there's a lot of water to go under the bridge. Pillar two is actually addressing the key drivers of extinctions.
Mm.
And that is that we have to stop the logging and clearing rates in Australia. We actually have to intervene in that particularly. You know, when the State of the Environment reports talks about the key threatening processes, and of course habitat loss, just mowing down these animals' trees is actually the thing that knocks them off most completely.
Course. Yeah.
I mean, invasive species, so feral pests as well as fire are now increasing challenges as well, and we have to address those. But until we can get under control, the fact that we still see our native vegetation as something to be logged, burned and shipped off, we will continue to see the disintegration of our native animals. So I think it's what's really interesting on this is that at Glasgow, the COP 26 in November, this connection between climate change and trees was really explicitly noted for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
The Glasgow Leaders Declaration on Forests and Land Use both made the explicit connection between the dual crises and committed governments to seeing the natural environment and our response to keeping trees upright as central to the climate change response.
Yeah.
So by signing that, Australia has actually committed to ending and reversing deforestation and forest degradation by 2030.
Yeah.
So we've got an international obligation. We've got a very clear set of responsibilities there. So that's a horny one, but one that can't be avoided.
Yeah, yeah.
And then finally, the third piece, I think, is the fact we've got all these carbon biodiversity markets coming our way.
Yes, yes.
So there's a wall of private capital coming the way of offsets. That's both voluntary commitments from corporations as well as this great big, you know, pile of demand that's going to come out of the safeguard mechanism.
Yes, yes.
And yet we cannot just let that be a nice financialisation of another thing that serves corporate interests and money moving around the money markets.
Mm.
We have to make it make sense. It doesn't make sense that the coalition government has spent billions of dollars of taxpayers' money in the last years paying people to plant trees while 280,000 hectares of functioning bushland is going down at the same time.
Mm.
That's called ludicrous,
called robbing Peter to pay Paul, isn't it?
It's just called stupid public policy. And more than that, and Labor Lean worked very, very hard, really, you know, we worked our guts out to get the commitment to the carbon markets review that's underway that Chris Bowen announced in the last couple of weeks, not only to address, I mean, our push sort of predates all the problems that Andrew McIntosh and so on have identified about the weaknesses of the market, but it was really about saying we actually have to, the market is a key tool in what is a bigger piece of policy challenge, which is how are we going to build a carbon sink at scale that also acts as a biodiversity arc and sink, and that, you know, we have to wrestle the markets into that public policy task, not the other way around.
Yes. Yeah. Again, if you haven't followed the credits debate, the most authoritative journalism that's been done on this question is by Adam Morton, my colleague, Guardian Australia's environment and climate editor. If you go to our website and you search his byline, you'll see a bunch of stories about this, including stories about the review of the system that the government has just set up, which is going to be led by a former chief scientist, Ian Chubb. And look, the sort of simple version of this is the credits become very important if you're actually reducing emissions, which is what this government proposes to do through the safeguard mechanism. If you actually propose to have, if you have policy that drives a downward trajectory in emissions, companies do two things. They either reduce their emissions, who'd have thunk it, or they basically buy emissions reduction that has occurred elsewhere in order to acquit their responsibilities. That's the simple way of explaining it. So what Felicity's saying is that there is a review to make that system genuine and also make it not just the biggest boon that the global capital markets have seen since, you know, I don't know, the Industrial Revolution or whatever, but actually set up a policy mechanism that drives the result rather than just shifts money around and obligations around the globe. So she was very clear, but I'm just reinforcing that because I just know, even for fellow climate and energy nerds, you say the word credit and eyes start to glaze over.
Yeah, so anyway, it's complicated.
It's complicated.
And of course, important in that too is those two things that trees are the only negative emission technology we've got that works. Yeah. So it really is the net and net zero.
Yes.
And then, of course, while they're standing, they're continuing to sequester carbon. So by far the best way is to not let things get knocked over. So we don't have any, this market does not keep things standing up.
Yeah.
It only plants things. And at the moment, you know, the critique is it plants things in places that aren't really important.
Yeah.
We need to, I mean, there's a concern from environmentalists, which is very fair, that, you know, it becomes a cheap way to avoid reducing emissions at source.
Yes.
However, if we make this an entire integrity system where it's actually delivering biodiversity and high levels of carbon,
yes,
then they will be expensive.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
they will drive down that incentive to cheat.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing, of course, and fundamentally, is we need to bring into that system the actual high carbon landscapes, the forests, you know, all those woodlands that are being cleared in Queensland. We have to bring them into the system. We actually have to draw a map in the end. We have to draw a map which brings together the highest carbon and the highest biodiversity valuable areas and make sure the market is invests there rather than wherever market.
Exactly. You set a premium on investing in the right areas. And you know, what do you know? The money follows the premium. So, okay, very good. And is that's
my three bits of architecture.
Okay.
So the laws and the institutions to support them, dealing with the key drivers, which is logging and clearing, and then making the markets work for us.
Yeah.
If we do those things right, we will have a revolution in the way we are managing Australia's environment.
Yeah. And that really would be something. I want to move us to climate because obviously we're facing down the first couple of sitting weeks of the new parliament and I'm very interested in your views about that. But before I push us there, I'm just interested, have you found the new ministers, the incoming environment and climate ministers, so Plibersek and Bowen respectively, are the doors open? Are you getting good access? Are they managing stakeholders effectively? What's the early situation report on that?
Look, it's funny for us advocates, you know, it's a whole new world where we used to be kind of a key source of advice and now they've got thousands of public servants who,
yeah,
who are very expert. So it is definitely a sort of a change and, you know, everyone's getting used to that. But, you know, from my point of view, I think both those ministers, and I put Murray Watt in this because he's an important piece
of
in
course.
This. You
yeah,
know,
yeah,
if we're going
is.
To
and
turn around.
Jenny McAllister.
Yeah, yeah. 70% of Australia's land is in private ownership. It's not public. So that's, you know, so Murray's role will be very important. But I believe, you know, I don't think we could have done better in a set of four ministers who have the job to getting this done. And they will be careful, they will be respectful of stakeholders, but I think they also understand the imperative and, you know, are committed to working with, you know, to give some of the journalists pushing back on Tanya today were saying, oh, come on. And, you know, she's only been in the seat for 6 weeks and, you know, still getting around talking to stakeholders. So I think we should... Yes, maintain the faith.
But it is important, isn't it, notwithstanding, you know, your very respectful caveats, which I would endorse. I mean, the woman has only been there for 6 weeks. But in terms of, you know, Labor's climate agenda, which it's been using all around the world to reset relationships and open doors and all of that sort of stuff to bring Australia back into some relationships that really matter to us in a national interest sense, you know, I think Tanya Plibersek's role, I mean, well, they're all important in their different spheres. But the two areas are interconnected, environment and climate. And if you want to achieve your climate objectives, fixing up the environment is a pretty important investment in achieving those things, right? So I imagine, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I imagine Lean's expectations of the new environment minister is that she might actually use the platform she's been given.
Certainly. Like, I mean, I think we're very keen and we've been pushing for this. And I think, you know, the government are thinking through this is how we coordinate across those portfolios, how we really build an integrated approach, because it won't work otherwise.
Mm.
We have to get working together. We have to work out, you know, just how, you know, they're very, it's all going to be subtle and complicated policy settings.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, Tanya's had a, you know, Tanya went off to Lisbon and, you know, as you reported,
yeah.
she had, you know,
got
made
a rousing
huge,
reception
yeah, yeah. the whole
like,
world
whoa.
Was just excited to see, you know, Labor saying we believe in this stuff.
Yeah.
And now I guess the hard work of actually making real policy that makes a difference.
Oh, exactly. You've got to deliver it. Otherwise it's just words, right? So let's think about the 43% legislation that will likely hit the parliament in the first, well, could be the second sitting week. I haven't actually checked, but look, it's 5 minutes to midnight. It's going to lob either week one or week two. Now, obviously, there is there are a lot of feelings about this around the place, and I'm not saying that in some patronising way. I have feelings about it myself, and for those of us who have been prosecuting the arguments in this debate, is it any wonder that there are feelings about this? Because there's been a whole lot of pent-up capacity in this system for quite a long period of time. So anyway, feelings are fine, but at the end of the day, the legislation will either pass or it won't. Now, the Greens, I had a long conversation with Adam Bandt on this show last week, and a lot of you listened, I know, because you've been in touch about it. The Greens have got a decision to make. You know, everyone's got to respect everybody else's electoral ground. Everyone has a mandate for something. That's all absolutely legit. But at the end of the day, this legislation will either pass or it will fail. Now, you know, what is your view on this? What should the Greens do?
It's probably not any surprise what my views on what the Greens should do. I mean, I think we're all, to what you've just said, Catherine, got the PTSD experience of we've been here before. You know, this election did give a rousing endorsement for climate action, but we were in this place in 2007 and we watched it all go wrong.
Yep.
We saw partisan bickering destroy that consensus in the Australian community, and we saw ourselves lose, you know, the 10 or 15 years it's been since that the consensus held. I think it's really important, you know, the Labor, the Greens and the Teals, you know, need to work together, obviously. But, you know, I think one of the things that really annoys me about how the Greens position on this stuff is, of course, it's in their interests to make Labor really bad, but Labor are not climate sceptics. Labor have turned up again and again to try and solve this problem. Labor is the party that, you know, has made all those, you know, that actually protected the Franklin, that actually, you know, protected Kakadu, that actually put in the biggest marine reserves in the world. You know, we're a party where, you know, Lean gets, you know, as we just explained, you know, the membership is totally behind action on this stuff, and so is the parliamentary party. So, you know, but I guess fundamentally, we're also a party who has to govern for the whole of the country. And we saw what happened in 2019. And since then, one of the things Lean did post-2019 was set up the Hunter Jobs Alliance, which was really our response to the Joel Fitzgibbon had a response to 2019, where the AMWU, which is one of the big manufacturing workers unions, Steve Murphy, their national secretary, and I had a moment of, you know, connection where I went and spoke to his people, and, you know, we realised that, you know, that the way that jobs and environment had been set up against each other was ludicrous and we needed to work together. So the Hunter Jobs Alliance is a coalition of environment and climate change, environment and unions that really sits in the middle of that community and says, how are we going to fix this? And look, those communities didn't come out with baseball bats this time.
Yep.
Probably, you know, I think that's from the hard work of so many of those sitting in the Hunter and in places like Gladstone and Central Queensland more broadly. But those communities aren't ready for us to rip the whole thing from under their feet. And, you know, even if you can do it electorally, even if you can imagine you can do it with billionaires and urban people, we cannot face the rip in social cohesion that doing this without care delivers.
Mm.
So Labor has promised 43%. They got elected on 43%. There is nowhere to go for Labor on that. There's important probably stuff around making sure the language sort of makes that a floor, not a ceiling, which has been much discussed.
Yeah.
But in the end, and I mean, of course, importantly, the environment groups, Australian Conservation Foundation and Greenpeace have come out and said, don't stuff it, Greens. You know, if you like to use the kind of labour analogy, you know, the unions, the industrial arm and, you know, the Labour Party are their political representation. The Greens and the environment groups are a little bit the same. And, you know, the fact that the environment groups are telling the Greens to pull their heads in, I think, is very important. We've watched Biden win on climate change and then the politics to go all go wrong. And we're sitting here with lived experience and these guys can blow it up in the interests of electoral, you know, the 10% of us who are wealthy enough and comfortable enough to see environment as trumping all cost of living and day-to-day concerns, they can build that constituency and destroy our pathway.
And it's sort of, you make the point that I think, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's, look, you know, Chris Bowen has made it clear that if the 43% doesn't pass the parliament, Labor will implement the 43%. Labor will, via regulatory and other means, just keep going towards that objective. So, you know, look, if you were highly sceptical, you might say, look, in practical terms, well, what does it matter? It's a symbolic vote, blah, 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 blah. Why does it matter? Why does it matter if this fails?
It matters really, as you say, it matters because of symbolism. It matters about the political task of putting the war behind us. It matters in terms of us working together, you know. I mean, I guess this is, you know, I come from the Wilderness Society. That's where I started. I have been in an organisation where wilderness, no compromise is the slogan.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, why I've ended up in the Labor Party is because I just see the consensus is the only way we do these things, with climate change being so hard. You know, this 43% is going to take huge changes in our economy. It's going to be a huge fight to work out how to get that safeguard mechanism in place.
Yep.
There's going to be huge amounts of investment and pain and, you know, transmission lines through people's backyards and all sorts of stuff to deliver that 43%. And to belittle that around a sort of a kind of symbolic argument about a higher target is crazy. But the legislation matters because, well, legislation matters because it actually holds things, makes it law. Mm-hmm. And we all know how things go wrong when the laws get taken away. And it matters because, yeah, it's about the parliament taking leadership and saying we're working together on this.
Mm. Well, parliament, hopefully you're listening. And we are rollicking towards the parliament. Basically, it'll kick off from next Tuesday for folks listening at the weekend. So, you know, pack or make sure you're hydrated, plenty of snacks. You know, because it's going to be a big couple of weeks and it's going to be a big 6 months between now and the end of the year as everybody, you know, starts to relearn habits, learn new ones and work through some really wicked problems as we've discussed over the last half an hour or so, Felicity. So thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate your frankness. Appreciate you guys for listening. I appreciate Miles Martignoni, who is the EP of the show. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.